Does anyone have any questions or reports or comments about the meditation practice? This being the last of the 5-week introductory course series. Golden opportunity to ask questions. Yes?
Well, no, if I have a question, it was just something that happened that was unusual.
Please.
I was reading this morning about a book, a spiritual book about death and dying, and then I sat down to sit, and what happened was, all of a sudden, I just started crying for about, I don't know, it felt like 20 minutes, and just not feeling necessarily. And it had to do with emotion, death and dying. And so obviously there must be some emotions connected, but I guess I could have stopped myself, but it felt like there was something else that was happening that was making me cry uncontrollably.
Yeah, I've had that experience from meditation also. And probably the important, there's a lot to be said about what you just talked about, but probably the important things to say in this context is that one of the ways of understanding a meditation practice is that we're getting out of our own way. And so most of the time we're in our way. There's too many cooks in the kitchen kind of thing. And so we inhibit the free flow, free expression of that which is inside of us. And often very deep movements of expression, of feelings, of motivation don't get a chance to surface because we're so distracted, we're running around, we're so resisting them or whatever. But in meditation, what we're aiming for is to kind of just to be so unresistant, so accepting, so open to let whatever's deep inside bubble up and just do what it needs to do.
Even if it does, if you can't find some meaning in it.
I remember once early in my meditation practice, I was sitting with a group, and I felt this overwhelming sadness, despair actually was the word, despair that bubbled up during the sitting. And all I could do, because I could barely keep myself from crying, because I didn't want to cry in the group, you know, for whatever reason. And so then I went, afterwards I went and talked to the teacher and described what had happened. And he just simply said, "Oh, sooner or later it has to come. Sooner or later it has to be, you know, sooner or later it has to be come out." And that pulled the cork. And I went to my room and I just, you know, cried for 20 minutes. And to this day, I don't know what the despair is about. There's no story connected to the despair. It was just the emotion, the feeling needed somehow to flow. And I'd finally gotten out of the way with the help of that little comment. So I mean, there's a lot more to talk about the kind of experience you had, but the important thing here is really recognize the tremendous power of getting out of our own way. And it requires not only ability to do that, but it also helps to have some trust that it's a valuable thing to do. Because most people feel like, oh, you know, I have to always be resisting, I have to always be making something happen or getting in my way or something. And simply to, you know, get completely out of our own way can seem frightening for some people.
Another thing happened a while ago, a couple of times, and then recently again. I found myself like a pendulum moving back and forth like this, and again it felt uncontrolled. I could stop it, but I didn't start it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't keep it.
Uh-huh.
That felt very odd.
Yeah, that can also happen. There's a number of that happens to people when they some people when they sit. And sometimes explained as being releases, but there's other reasons why it can happen. But the muscles in our body, which holds a lot of tension, begins to release, begins to move, begins to flow. Some various things begin to happening, and as that release and relaxation and opening begins happening, some people have the experience of the body moving, sometimes rhythmically like a pendulum, sometimes in unrhythmic ways, and it seems like, you know, I'm not doing this; it's happening to me. And usually it works, sorts itself out after with time. It's like it's something. It's like a discharge that needs to happen for a while, or it's another. It's a little bit hard to know exactly how to interpret these. There's a lot of, you know, good interpretations of what's actually happening, and the most common one is that it's some kind of release or some kind of discharge that's happening. And sometimes it can be quite dramatic. You know, where I remember sitting in the meditation. Thank you. Sitting in the meditation hall, and it was a period of my practice where I would my arms would somehow just fly out like that suddenly. I had no warning. It was just like this, you know. And this, it felt like this great release of energy, a release of tension or something. And once it was both my hands and my feet. And I almost like jumped off the cushion. Where did that come from? And I felt lucky I didn't hit the person next to me. It can be dangerous to sit in the meditation hall with people. So there are unusual things that happen, and what you described is well within the common repertoire of what we would consider unusual. Questions? Any questions about meditation practice or the instructions so far?
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Last week you talked about the knowing when we're paying attention to our thoughts and when we're not paying attention to our thoughts. Can you say something about the knowing when we're not thinking with other kinds of perceptions? Is it also in a kind of a thinking mode, or what more is that about? Can you say about that sense of knowing?
The knowing. Well, knowing is central to mindfulness practice, and we use different synonyms for knowing, or seemingly, especially when we talk kind of casually, we use the word awareness, attention, knowing, mindfulness, and kind of synonymously, as if they're all the same thing. And then in relationship to thinking, we can certainly be thoughtful about things. We can think about things. I can think about this carpet. And I can also see the carpet. I can feel the carpet. And that seeing and feeling of it is a sensory experience. And then in between thinking about something and having a sensory experience of something, there is a knowing that that's what it is. I mean, you probably had the experience. I'll tell you a story. Maybe it should not be told. It's kind of dramatic, but it's a story of one of the most important masters of Korean Buddhism, Korean Zen teacher. And he was a student of Buddhism in Korea, and he wanted to go to China to study with the great Zen masters in China. And he was taking a boat to China, and he was shipwrecked. And somehow he made it to shore in the middle of the dark of the night, and he found his way into something that seemed like some shells raining terribly, and he found himself into some shelter. It was a really dark night. He couldn't see hardly at all, but he found himself into a little shelter. He thought it was a little cave or something, structure, and he found himself really thirsty after being in the ocean for those many hours, and he kind of felt around in this little dry structure, and he found, wow, a bowl. And it seemed like there was water in the bowl, probably, from the rainwater or something. And so he drank, and it tasted like fresh water. It tasted great. And he felt, revived, and he slept for the night. And in the morning he woke up to discover that he had found his way to a cemetery and into a little crypt. And the bowl that he picked up to drink the water from was someone's skull. And he immediately got really sick and nauseous and ran to the ocean or somewhere to throw up. And then he had his awakening experience. And I don't know exactly why he had his awakening experience with that, but I think part of it was he understood the tremendous power of the mind to add interpretations and judgments on top of raw experience. The mind does more than just pick up sense things, but it interprets things in certain ways. And so, somewhere between sensing something and thinking about it, there's a realm of knowing what it is. So I could put my hand down if I couldn't see, And I could feel this. I can feel, oh, this is, you know, certain texture, smoothness, and all kinds of things. Like I can feel the sensations of that. And then I could know, oh, this is a carpet. Or if I was in, you know, if I had no way of knowing where I was at all, and my hand, my eyes closed, and I went down and touched the floor, I wouldn't know it was a carpet. It could be, you know, the seat of a car, or it could be, you know, the blanket of a camel, or it could be, there's a lot of things it could be. I wouldn't actually know if it was a carpet. So the knowing, oh, this is a carpet, is a kind of a thought, but it's a very rudimentary, simple thought of recognition. But it's not thinking about it. Now, it can get even more refined than that, closer to the bare sensation, is that I can not only know this is a carpet, but I can know that this is textured. I can know this is the texture of this, the temperature of this. I can know what the direct sensations are. I can have the sensations and feel them, and I can know what they are. So, for example, if I'm going to tell you, oh, this is a rough carpet, you know, feeling of roughness in my hands, I have to have that recognition as a kind of word, roughness, in order to be able to put it into words to tell you, oh, there's a rough feeling here. So there's a very, very simple, very elementary, and we could say very natural functioning of the mind, which is to cognize our experience, is to kind of recognize what the experience is. And it's part of what makes up the human being, is to have that cognizing ability to, oh, this is what it is. And it happens as a very rudimentary form of a word, of a cognitive ability, as opposed to just the pure sensing of something. And we can have a sense of sensing something as being different from our very simple cognizing of what something is. So the mindfulness practice is built on sensing, on the raw awareness of things, but it's one step, very, very simple, small step, away from that to the mental ability to cognize, this is what I'm experiencing. So I can be thinking, and I can know, I can be cognizant of the fact that I'm thinking. I can be feeling, see flickering light. I can sense it and feel what it's like in my eyes and the little irritation it does. And I can know light, I can know flickering light, I can know the little bit of discomfort in my right eye as it's kind of happening here on my, you know, flickering against my eye, the sunlight through the trees. So a very simple knowing of that. In my experience, or my sense, or my understanding, however poor it might be, is that there's no fine boundary or barrier or levels between raw sensation on one end of the spectrum and the other end of the spectrum thinking about things, you know, completely wildly and abstractly. It's actually a kind of a graded slope between the two, in a sense. And it's very hard to, you know, so there's in practice, there's always some, if nothing else, very rudimentary verbalization or cognizing that goes on in every experience we have. So Buddhism doesn't posit the idea of pure sensation or pure experience unmediated by cognition, unmediated by words, in a sense. Which is a little bit disappointing to some people who feel that, you know, that words are kind of like the problem and the enemy, and real experience is to be free of words. But the people who have that kind of idea usually haven't investigated carefully enough, because it's very easy to have the sense that there's no words happening, I'm experiencing without any words. And what the person's really saying is that they've dropped a whole level of coarse verbalization. And the cognitive functioning of knowing is really, really fine and subtle. And you have to have a very fine and subtle mind sometimes to see how it operates. That it's actually, there is a level of cognition going on, and it isn't pure sensation unmediated by thought. Does that make sense? So mindfulness is built on this ability for us to be able to cognize what's happening in the moment. So I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say this, but this particular introductory class group seems more reticent to ask questions than most, or slower to ask questions, or maybe they're just, you know, maybe you're just really sharp, and there's no need to ask questions. You say, I say something, you know, I say a little hint of something, and you fill in. Yes.
I apologize. I came in a little late, so. But you're saying that there, in Buddhism, there's no pure sensation, and that, I mean, there is a difference between pure sensation and then labeling it, right?
Yes, sure. That's pretty obvious.
Okay. So, when you're being mindful, aren't you being aware of the labeling of the sensation with words?
Also, yes. Labeling is not mindfulness. It's an aid to mindfulness. And so some people do mindfulness practice without labeling.
Well, take an animal, for instance, a non-human animal. Some people believe that human beings are the only creatures on Earth who have selves, meaning that the human being is the only creature that makes an object of himself.
Or herself.
Okay, so when a dog, for instance, has a sensation of touch or thirst, presumably the dog doesn't say to himself or herself, because the dog does not have a self and is not self-aware, the dog does not say, I'm thirsty, or I just experienced touch. The dog is just one with the environment, right?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe. Buddha, I don't know. You know, I never heard any Buddhists ever make theories about the difference between animal world and human world in terms of this idea of a self. But it's very clear that Buddhism teaches that the self is a construct, that there is no self outside of our construction of a self, which of course is very insulting to some of us who think that, you know, I have a very good self, thank you, and I've always had a good self or whatever. But a self is a construct, and that, you know, so it's easy to imagine that some animals that don't have that abstract functioning of mind wouldn't have that creation of that kind of construct. But even dogs know that if they have an itch, they don't go itch the neighbor's dog. They don't go scratch the neighbor's dog if they have it. You know, if they're the ones that itch, they scratch themselves, right? So there's some sense of difference. So the point is that there is a tendency in Western philosophical traditions to posit the possibility of a pure perception. And sometimes when Buddhism has come to the West, especially through the Zen schools, this idea has been kind of highlighted, you know, that you can have pure perception, unmediated by thought, and that's the whole point of it, isn't it? And as far as I can know, the Buddhism never posits the possibility of experience unmediated by thought, short of nirvana itself. And in nirvana, there's no thought because there's no mind. And then you say, well, what's the point then? you know, but our perceptual organs are already entangled with our cognitive background. And it's always that way. And you can certainly clarify your perceptions. And one of the beautiful things that happens through meditation or something like meditation, happens especially if you go on retreat, meditation retreats, is that you come out of your meditation and look at the trees or look at something outside of, and you'll see something afresh in a way you've never seen it before. It's like everything's glowing and sparkling, and you realize that the only reason that things aren't sparkling and so vividly alive all the time is that your eyesight is somehow clouded with all the thoughts and momentum and distractions and worries that we have. And with all those worries and everything, all those things drop away, we see things much more vividly. Like the story of Larry Rosenberg, who meditated one afternoon in Cambridge, and then walked down out of his apartment and waited for a friend on the sidewalk, and as he was waiting, there was a yellow cab parked right there too, and he was just blown away by the yellowness of the cab. You know, it's kind of like you're on acid. Wow, yeah, yellow. You know, like you've never seen yellow before, because our perceptions can be cleansed through meditation, but not purified in the sense that there's we're completely empty of all cognitive factors, all backgrounds. So I don't know if that made sense or it was interesting to most of you, but that's, yes.
In Buddhism, everything is about the self itself.
What the self is, from the point of view of Buddhism, what the self is, there's no self outside of our construction of a self.
Okay. I think where I'm getting confused, and I know I don't have a complete understanding of rebirth in Buddhism. I mean, if everything is self-construct, then when you die, everything should go away. There shouldn't be any rebirth.
Well, you know, I have a PhD in Buddhist studies, and I've looked into this to some degree, and I can't make good sense of the Buddhist explanations of how rebirth happens. So it could be that I'm a little bit slow, but you know, I put in my time. You know, I have some credentials to kind of try to make sense of this. So that maybe is not very satisfying to hear me say that, but I haven't gotten a good explanation. But the best explanation that I know of for how rebirth might happen is that it's like the waves in the ocean, and we can look from a distance, it looks like the same wave, or in a sense the same thing, same wave is going from Japan to California across the Pacific Ocean. But if you look carefully at the wave, there's no thing which is moving across the Pacific. The water particles are just moving up and down, and as they move up and down, they hit the one next to them, and it moves up and down. It's like the wave in the sports theaters, right? You know about the wave, right? I mean, there's no thing which is moving across the stadium, but it has the illusion of something moving because everyone's kind of coordinating their, right? So same thing with the waves in the ocean. Same thing with rebirth. There's no thing. Everything kind of deconstructs. But before it deconstructs, it bumps into what's next to it and puts a certain spin on it. And that spin continues, you know, one after the other, right? So each life is like one particle of water in the ocean of life. And so at the end of that life, when that wave kind of drops, that water particle drops, it does, before it drops, disappears or whatever, it strikes the one next to it. So there's no thing, there's no entity, there's no that goes gets reborn, but there is continuity. So there's no thing, there's no thing which moves across the ocean, but there is, we can talk about continuity of something, of energy or momentum or whatever. So the same thing with consciousness. There's no thing of consciousness which survives death, but there is momentum. There is continuity, and there's some integrity to that stream. And from Buddhist teachings, we are the recipient of a particular unique stream that preceded us in our lives, from lives before. But that's not exactly us. Buddhists would probably not want to say, "Oh, you know, I had this vision and I realized that I used to be Cleopatra." Wow, you know. it's not like, you know, that's who we are, who we were. It's more like, oh, that's the stream that feeds into this street where I'm right now. But we don't claim it for ourselves, though there's some integrity to it. This is an intro class. Just basic mindfulness. So maybe we should sit. They're good questions. So take a comfortable, alert posture. And it's useful to think of meditation practice as being a balancing of different factors, so we don't get stuck on it being one thing. So the balance between being relaxed and being alert. The balance between applying effort and being calm. And then to begin by taking a few deep breaths. It can be very useful to take deep breaths at the beginning of a sitting and to use the in-breath, breathing in deeply into the torso and stomach, as a way of feeling connected to your body from the inside. And then as you breathe out fully, to kind of let go of everything, your muscles, your tension, your body, your mind, your thoughts. And then letting your breathing return to normal. And then also taking a few moments to scan through your body for any obvious places of holding that might be easy to soften, let go of. Sometimes it's possible to relax the whole body. Many of us brace ourselves against life. It's possible to let go of that and just be present and open. And then becoming aware of your body's experience of breathing. Feeling the body's experience of expansion and contraction as you breathe. The body's experience of moving and movement, pressure. allowing yourself to feel the sensual quality of breathing. And see if you can release yourself into your breathing. Rest your awareness on the oscillating sensations of breathing. When you notice the mind has wandered off in thoughts, notice that. Really notice that. And then see if it's possible to relax that thinking mind before you return to your breathing. Meditative awareness is an allowing awareness, staying firmly, committedly in the present moment, but allowing whatever is in the present to come freely. when strong sensations in the body arise, our meditative awareness centers itself on those sensations. When strong emotions arise, then the meditative awareness takes in those strong emotions, allowing them to be there. And when very strong compulsive thinking happens, then the meditative silent awareness sees clearly the thinking. And in this way, our capacity to know becomes stronger. And as our knowing of what's happening in present becomes stronger, the knowing disentangles itself from what is known. The knowing becomes independent of the pains we feel, the emotions we feel, the thoughts we have. What is it that needs to be accepted so that you can be more fully present? Letting your knowing become freer. it's possible sometimes to be mindful of what is happening for you in the moment, and then what your relationship is to what is happening. Are you reacting to what's happening? And sometimes seeing very clearly the reactivity doesn't necessarily get rid of it, but sets us free from it, loses its power over us. In a few moments, I'm going to ring the bell 3 times to end this. And then after the 3rd ring, bring your attention to your eyes, your eyelids. And then mindfully open your eyes and allow yourself to see. Don't try to see or look intentionally. Just allow seeing to happen. And then become aware of what happens inside of you, your thoughts and reactions, as you come out of your meditative space. When people meditate, it's a common tendency to focus a fair amount on the process of settling into meditation, calming down, or whatever happens. And then there can be some attention given to trying to hold on to whatever settledness or calm that a person has acquired. But a very important area of mindfulness is the area as we come out of our calm, as we come out of our meditation, at the end of the meditation, as we begin resuming our normal way of being, normal activity. And there's a teaching in Buddhism that a lot of the deep insight that can come from practice comes in a transition out of meditation, or out of, if you've been on a meditation retreat, as you leave the retreat and come back to your normal life. And the way it works is that to some degree, and it can be maybe a very small degree, as we get a little bit calmer in meditation, more settled, the normal activity of the mind begins quieting down. The normal way in which we construct who we are, the normal way in which we represent ourselves to ourselves and to other people, the ways in which we think about other people and think about our place in the world and our relationship to the world and our problems and all these things often tend to start coming back. And there's an opportunity from the vantage point, from the perspective of being a little bit calmer and not having those things happen, there's an opportunity to notice them happening in a much clearer way coming out of meditation than if you had to try to notice them in the middle of your busy life when your mind is kind of flying all over the place. So for example, you're sitting in meditation in the morning and you come out of your meditation and you stay very mindful as you get up from your sitting and go to your kitchen to make yourself your breakfast, and then at some point you notice this little pang in your stomach. Oh, there's a lot to do. Oh, there's not enough time. Oh, there's the newspaper, there's the radio, there's the breakfast. Let's bring them all together and try to kind of, you know, read the paper and listen to the radio and eat, you know, and talk to my spouse all at the same time. And then we feel a little bit, then you start to notice you're getting kind of hairy because you can't do them all very well, and start feeling a little bit disconnected from your spouse or from the newspaper or from yourself, and then you're already kind of a little off because so much is going on. And then you realize, oh, but you know, you're supposed to stop at the store on the way to work and better rush out the door, and you feel even more anxious. And you weren't anxious when you ended meditation, but by the time you get to work, you're already frantic. And you slowly build that anxiety step by step. And if you try to notice and understand the complexity of your anxiety when it's all full-blown, it's hard to see it. But if you pay very careful attention as you come out of meditation, you might start noticing the small building blocks that add up to the full-blown franticness that sometimes we have, or the full-blown personality that we've kind of created for ourselves or whatever. So the transition out of meditation is very important. Now, it isn't just simply noticing how we get anxious, but also it's possible to notice the way in which we interpret our experience and how interpretation sometimes is extra. In the middle of our life, we don't often see that interpretation is extra. Interpretation is the way things are. And this is the example I like to give. I can hold up a flower like this, and you can maybe see the flower, and the flower is just a flower. You see it, you see the flowerness of the flower, the dustness of the flower. It's a nice flower. So you see the flower, great. So what? But if I take a different flower and put it next to the first flower, then something, I can say something that I couldn't say before. And that is, I can say, this is now the small flower and this is the big flower. This is the short flower, this is the tall flower. The tallness, the smallness, the shortness, the bigness of these flowers doesn't reside in the flower in and of itself. It resides in my ability, my mind, to compare the two together. It's a part of comparative thinking that creates that. And it's, you know, some accuracy to it. And I have, you know, amazing magical powers, which you probably didn't know about. Because now this is the short one, right? And now, it's the big one, the tall one, right in front of your eyes. Did you, I don't know if you could catch how quickly my hands had to move to do that magic trick. But somehow I made this into a big flower before it was a small flower. So then you might say, well, so what? When I was 13, I lived in 1967. I lived in a small city in Italy. And having come from California, I was the hippest, coolest kid in town. I was the only one with blue jeans. I was the only one with somewhat longish hair. And I knew that I was cool. And I had a certain kind of energy and aliveness and sense of kind of, you know, cool. You know, I was up about myself and up about life, you know, being kind of the progressive edge of this little town in Italy. And then at the end of the summer, I flew back to California. And a lot had happened in California in the summer of 1967. So I still had, you know, everyone was still wearing blue jeans and had long hair, but their hair had grown up out a lot longer than mine the course of the summer. And they had figured out to wash their blue jeans 10,000 times and to tear them and to patch them up again in the course of the summer. And so I was no longer cool. And my energy and happiness in myself kind of dropped. And what had happened was I was comparing myself to a different group of people. In Italy, I was comparing myself to a certain group of people and their length of their hair. And in California, I was comparing myself to another group of people and their different length of hair. And my sense of well-being, personal well-being, and depended on who I was comparing myself to. So just in the same magical way as I could change the size of the flower, crossing the Atlantic, and, you know, had the same magic effect on me. Much of the ways in which we construct ourselves and much of the way in which we suffer around ourselves arises out of comparative thinking, which is optional, which is kind of magical. You know, it's kind of like, you know. And if we could really see that, then how it actually works, we would actually free ourselves from a lot of suffering. A lot and lots of suffering. So what I'm suggesting is that as you come out of, even just a modicum of a meditative state, a little bit calmer than usual, there's an opportunity there, if you come out of that mindfully, to notice how your mind begins to work, how you begin comparing yourself to others. And you have a much better chance of doing that coming out of some calm than you do when you're already kind of, you know, lost in the busyness of the world. So in the course of these last 4 weeks, I've given you the simple basic instructions for mindfulness meditation. And we've talked about how the breath, meditating on the breath, mindfulness of the breathing, is the anchor or the center of the practice. It's a place where we develop our ability to be mindful, develop our ability to stay in the present moment. You only breathe in the present moment. You're only aware of your breathing in the present moment. And so as you stay with each breath, you're training yourself to be in the present moment, which is phenomenally useful. And staying with the breath is very helpful for calming us down, for disentangling us from all our normal concerns, and so the mind has a chance to settle and relax. However, when something else in our experience becomes more compelling than the breath, the practice of mindfulness is to let go of the breath and bring our meditative awareness to that experience. So if it's some strong sensation in the body, we bring our attention to those sensations. If it's a compelling sound around you, the sounds are not a distraction, it's just something else to bring your meditative attention to. Hearing, just be aware of listening. If it's a strong emotion, we just bring our meditative awareness to strong emotion, which means we get out of its way, we let it do what it wants, we give it its freedom. But we see clearly what it is. We don't interfere with it, but we see clearly, oh, this is what's going on. And we stay with it as long as it's there. We develop our ability to be in the present and to relax in the present on that strong emotion. If it's compelling thoughts, we do the same thing. We bring this silent, non-discursive awareness to notice, oh, I'm thinking. To help us disengage with the content of our thought, to disengage the story making, to just see it for what it is. And this way, everything in our experience is meant to be included in mindfulness practice. There's nothing which is considered outside the practice. That means there's no such thing as a distraction. It's just something else to pay attention to. And so what we're doing is, in a sense, kind of metaphorically, making ourselves the calm, centered center of all our experiences, And that calm, luminous, knowing center is not what it is. It just stays relaxed and calm and receives and is open to whatever is happening in our experience. Nothing is kept out of awareness. Nothing is unacceptable for awareness itself. We don't reject anything. We don't hold on to anything. And we slowly begin to discover this phenomenal, precious potential that we all have, which is hard to believe how precious it is because we don't see it, we don't really know it, but it's our capacity to know, the knowing quality. To set our knowing free is to set ourselves free. To have a knowing which is not entangled with all the objects of desire and aversion is to set ourselves free from all those objects, to set ourselves free from aversion and desire, to find our independence, to be unswayed by the conditions of the world, unswayed by the eight worldly, it's what's called the eight worldly dharmas, so that success and failure, blame and praise, fame and ill repute, comfort and discomfort don't push us off center, don't push us out of our freedom, out of our disentangledness. And it's a knowing which kind of sets free. The image in Buddhism that's used is that the lotus growing out of muddy water, out of the mud of our life. This lotus block, first bud kind of pops up out of the water, and then above the water it blossoms, and the white lotus is completely clean and pure, untouched by the mud that it grows out of. And so the knowing quality gets stronger and stronger and eventually kind of grows up and becomes bigger and purer and above all the conditions of our life, which is a phenomenally freeing experience to have. So that's, you know, in a very short description what the practice entails. And there's a number of ways then of continuing the practice. One is simply to use it as a daily meditation practice and just useful, you know, for purposes of stress reduction, coping with pain, coping with anxiety. It's good for our health. It's good for our mental health. It's good for our neighbors. Just, you know, has very practical purposes, very useful, you know, in very simple ways. But it's also possible to take it further than just a simple meditation practice. And there's two primary directions that you can take it. One is you can bring it into more into your daily life. So it's not just simply something you do in meditation, but you start cultivating more presence, more mindfulness, more being in the present, knowingly, clearly seeing what's happening in the present in the rest of your life, in your daily life. So that as you're driving your car, you don't listen to the radio and comment on everyone else's driving and plan the rest of the day or review conversations or daydream or whatever you do, but you drive the car so you're really present for driving. You're aware that now you're driving, you're in the present moment, and you develop your capacity to be luminously present and aware in the present, just driving. It's a practice. The mind wanders off. You come back to just driving, being there on the road. You extend it into simple tasks, daily tasks, like washing the dishes at home, or cooking a meal, or cleaning the house. Maybe extend it into shopping. Okay, I'm not going to shop in the usual way, frantically, and to get it over with. But I'm going to shop in order to develop my mindfulness, be really present for shopping. If you go to a big supermarket, there's a lot of sparkling colors that you can just be dazzled by if you're really present for what's there. Just it's a you know, you don't have to be on acid. All you have to do is go to Safeway and be present. And then you can extend it into your relationships with talking to other people. Talking is a phenomenally easy place to lose our presence, not know what's going on. Many people are addicted to what they're saying. to this kind of addictive quality. We lose ourselves in the talking. And you see it very clearly in how often we interrupt each other. How often do you really listen to someone, or you're already formulating your answer? But learn to, you know, simply learn to listen mindfully and with presence. Meditative allowing that person to speak, and you just listen, just be present. And to be mindful as you speak. What are you going to say? What's the purpose of what you're going to say? What are you trying to get across? So there's a whole bunch of areas we can start paying attention in daily life. It's very powerful to do that. The more we tend to kind of go about life in automatic pilot, the more powerful it is to begin to wake up in the course of our life. As someone said earlier today, I don't know if this is exactly follows what I was saying, but he used to regularly try to figure out who he should be to please everyone else. And then he decided to just be himself and not worry about what other people thought. And then people started coming to him. As soon as he stopped pleasing others, trying to make a kind of special kind of person to he thought would please someone else, and just was honestly who he was and relaxed with who he was, then people started to be friendly towards him much more than they were. They were much more friendly towards him than when he was trying to be someone different than who he was. So mindfulness practice, to bring mindfulness in daily life, is to begin noticing, what are we actually doing in our daily life? How are we? Have we left our center? Are we no longer honest with who we are? What is it to be present for ourselves and then present who we are in the present moment in an honest way, as opposed to, you know, covering up who we are, trying to figure out how we're supposed to present ourselves to please the people around us? I know people who do all kinds of tricks or cues during the day to encourage them to themselves to wake up, to pay attention. I know some people use the telephone. Some people have a tendency to answering the telephone on the first ring or the first half ring, you know, like it's like really important to get there. And other people who have a policy, they never answer the phone before the third or the fourth or the fifth ring. And they use that time to just be mindful, to close their eyes maybe and be with their breathing and just be present, find out what's going on. It's very easy to spend a whole day not checking in with oneself. I find it kind of surprising sometimes still, maybe I should know better, but I might stop in the middle of the day to meditate. And I think I'm just fine, you know, things are just great, whatever. And as soon as I stop to meditate, only then do I notice how much momentum of tension I'm carrying in my shoulders and my body, and how I'm not actually so settled on myself. I don't really want to be this way. But because I'm so busy, I don't notice. But if I stop, I can notice. So some people use a telephone as a cue. For a long time, I used doorways. Whenever I went through a doorway, I was kind of moving into a new space anyway, I'd use that as a reminder to pay attention to what was going on, both in myself and the environment around me. Other people will use I've known people who have used little stickers, and put stickers in different things in their house. Whenever they see one of the little stickers, okay, let's notice what's going on now, as opposed to just racing ahead. And the idea is to start finding ways to start waking up and paying attention, being mindful throughout our daily life. In order to do that, it really helps that you have some sense that it's valuable to do that. If you don't think it's valuable to do that, you just think I'm crazy saying so. But you have to find some real value for yourself. You have some real deep sense of satisfaction, inspiration, some deep sense of connectedness with life and yourself, and some deep sense of importance or satisfaction in being present for ourselves as we actually are, both when we're feeling happy and when we're feeling unhappy. It's easy to feel, oh, it's great to be really present when we're happy, but can you have the same satisfaction when you're unhappy? There is actually a phenomenal satisfaction being present for oneself when one is unhappy, as opposed to not present for oneself, running away, numbing out. So developing that capacity to be present. Developing that ability to begin taming, in a sense, the mind, so the mind doesn't constantly rush off and freely kind of charge ahead in life without ever kind of stopping and noticing what's going on. The other way of that's one area, a whole area of developing practice is developing in daily life. The other whole area of developing practice is to do so by developing much more concentration together with the mindfulness. To couple mindfulness with a strong, concentrated mind. Concentration is the mind which is very stable and is able to look very keenly at what's going on now. It's one thing to notice that I'm feeling pain, some discomfort somewhere, but be able to hold the mind still and really study that discomfort and see, well, actually, it isn't the pain my knee is troubling me. It's really my mind is so reactive around that. It's so full of fear and anger and aversion. It takes a real steady mind to see that. And as we begin bringing more concentration together with the mindfulness, we begin dropping below the interpretive layer in which we mostly live our lives. So we start dropping below who we are as being a smaller or a bigger person to who we are in and of ourselves, independent of all the comparative thoughts. If you take away all ideas of who you have been in the past, and you take away all ideas of what you might become in the future, and you take away all ideas of who you are in comparison to other people, who are you? What's left? The possibility of real freedom is found right there, in that place. And as we begin finding that place, it's actually a place independent of our personal story, our personal biography, actually independent of what happened to us early in our life, what's going to happen to us, success and failures in our lives. And it's phenomenally empowering to discover there's some place inside of you, some essential core place of beingness, in a sense, which is not dependent on your story, your biography. And as we begin coupling concentration together with mindfulness and seeing very deeply, the mindfulness practice leads to seeing some of the deep universal characteristics, the universal truths of human life, as opposed to those personal insights that have to do with your biography or your story, your psychology. The universal psychological insights about human beings. And it's the universal insights into the universal truths that what is ultimately freeing. Because Buddhist practice ultimately is about becoming totally, completely free of all that binds us, all the shackles and fetters that keep us inhibited, keep us back, keep us driven, keep us addicted. So we really discover the possibility of freedom. So in order to develop greater concentration, it sure is important to meditate every day. It's very helpful to meditate with other people, with a group of other people. And there's a lot of meditation groups in the peninsula area. You're welcome to join us, our regular sitting groups. And there are other groups in the area that unconnected to us that you could join, meditate with. But to sit together with others is very supportive. You could also go on retreats. And for those people who really want to develop the mindfulness in a deep way and couple it with a great concentration and stillness, retreats are invaluable. One-day retreats, weekend retreats, 10-day retreats, longer retreats. We call them retreats, and you know, we're kind of like normal people in an urban setting, But the kind of retreats are kind of the in Buddhism is it's kind of what Buddhism has to offer. That's equivalent. I think all cultures have offered some very powerful ways of stepping outside our normal patterns of living, normal patterns of thinking, normal patterns of relating to the world, so we can see the world in a new way. The Native American vision quest. Jesus went to 40 days in the desert. We have retreats, you know, and they're very powerful experiences of deep meditative work, stepping outside of the normal context of our life, so we can see our life and see life in a much deeper way. So you can bring more mindfulness in your daily life. You can develop your concentration. You can go on retreats. And there's one more aspect I want to say about that's supportive of mindfulness practice, comes out of mindfulness practice, is one way of using mindfulness practice. And that is to begin paying attention, be mindful of what is the deepest intentions, what's the deepest wish that you have for your life. What's the deepest value? What's the deepest aspiration? What's your heartfelt deepest wish for yourself? What's the deepest intention you have for your life? That is a phenomenally important spiritual question, human question for anyone to address. And to begin answering that question is not always so easy. But begin starting to have some sense of that possibility, or start sensing what our deepest wish is. And then to let our spiritual practice, let our meditation practice, be an expression of that deep intention gives a lot more motivation for spiritual practice than if it was simply was for stress reduction. And then as the mindfulness develops and you have a greater ability to be still and quiet and see more deeply into your mind and heart, then you'll start discovering deeper and deeper intentions. You have access to deeper and deeper sources inside of you for powerfully satisfying motivations of how you what you want to base your life on. You understand what's really important, what the deepest priorities are for your life, and how important it might be to follow through on that. Buddhist spirituality is very intimately connected to our intentions. Not the intentions Buddhism says you should have, but the intentions that you discover that you have by paying careful attention and by becoming still. So that's the basically the 5-week introductory course in mindfulness, which I give about 3 times a year here. And next week we'll continue or return to our regular Thursday format, which is half an hour of sitting followed by discussion and talk and some more sitting, hopefully. In the next weeks after the introductory course, I kind of pretend that the introductory course hasn't ended. So I continue with topics that kind of would follow. So some of you might want to continue coming on Thursday for a while and learn more and find out more. Some of you might not want to come back ever. I find it very satisfying that in some ways that there are people who come here into a class and then I never see them again. It's very reassuring to me. Yes.
Is it the same time sitting?
7 o'clock. Yes. And I've talked a lot today, so maybe if you do come back, we have during regular Thursday sessions, we have much more chance for questions, usually. But before we end, it's only 8:20. What I'd like to do is let Steve talk to you for a minute. Steve is the president of our sitting group, and And people don't often have a sense when they come here that there's anything more than just me and the room or something. And it's important for all of us to realize there's actually a large kind of organization behind what we do here. And I'm just one player in this much bigger organization. And so I thought Steve was going to speak to you for about 5 minutes, and then we can end with a short period of silent sitting. Yes?
Please remind us of your name before.
My name?
Yeah.
Well, I'm Gil.
I knew that much.
What?
Go by any other name?
Gil Fronsdal. Fronsdal.
So,
I should also point out we're a very non-bureaucratic group, so I don't get the idea we're a bureaucratic group. I wanted to spend a couple of minutes going over the various other activities we have besides Thursday night. Thursday night program is very good, and encourage and welcome everybody to continue coming to that. We also have a Monday night program, which the center started out at Monday night here. And the formal program starts at 7:30. There's a sitting from 7:30 to a quarter after 8. And then from quarter after 8 to 9, there's a talk which is usually given by Gil. And if Gil is not here, he brings in excellent speakers, both in the Vipassana tradition and in the Zen tradition. And you're welcome to either come for the sitting or just come for the talk, either one. In addition, on Monday nights, there's a lot of other activities before the formal session. There's a yoga class, which I believe starts at 6:30. There's a whole schedule here, and I'll tell you in a minute how to get on our mailing list. There's a, like I said, there's a yoga group that meets in here, and they do yoga, and then they go into sitting.
Except for the first Monday,
where there's an introduction to meditation. And there's also a discussion group. It used to be a book discussion group, but now they discuss various topics in Buddhism, and they meet also at 6:30 in the library back there. And then on the third Monday, there's a potluck, and that starts 6:30?
Six.
And that meets down in the building over there, and you can get to interact with a lot of people here. Also on the third Monday, there's a children's group, which that starts at 7. Or 7. So that pretty much covers Monday. Then Monday's pretty crowded, so and also people wanted a Sunday program because they didn't get enough on Mondays and they wanted more of it, and also some people couldn't come on Mondays. The Sunday program was really nice. It's out in Portola Valley, and I have a bunch of maps which gives you directions, and you're welcome to come to all a part of that. And that formally starts at 8:30. There's one sitting from 8:30 to 9:10, and then there's a walking period from 9:10 to 9:25, and then from 9:25 to 10 there's another period, and from 10 to 10:45 there's a talk which Gil usually gives. And you can come to any of those or any part of it. In addition, this recently started 4 weeks ago, 3-4 weeks ago. There's a Qigong master who sits with us who gives a workout starting at 8 to 8:30. And I went to one of those. It's quite lively. Then on the fourth Sunday, there's a potluck, which we're having this Sunday, actually.
The last Sunday.
The last Sunday, yeah.
Is that Qigong on Sunday?
Yeah. And it starts also at Portola Valley at 8 o'clock.
Is that every Sunday? Or
yes, that's every Sunday. As I said, the potluck. And people afterwards get together and do stuff. A lot of people go on hikes. It's very beautiful out in Portola Valley. So that's the Sunday program. Then we have a number of one-day retreats on Saturdays, which are held over at St. Mark's, and those either start at 8:30 in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning, and they alternate. Ones that start at 9, Gil does a lot of guided meditations. on those, and the ones that start at 8:30, there's no guided meditation. It's more like taking a slice out of a regular retreat that you would sit on. And you're welcome to come to all a part of that. There's a number of people who just go in the morning, a number of people just come in the afternoon, so you don't have to feel embarrassed if you want to leave. A lot of people have done that. And then we also have several weekend retreats. We have one coming up this tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night?
At the Jokoji, and that's done twice a year. And we have various other events, and people have events at their houses informally. We have game nights and video nights and other stuff, which you're all welcome to come. And all these events are all done on the Donna system, or whatever you feel like giving pays for our programs. Another thing that we have is the Sati Center, which it's another organization. Gil is affiliated with it, and they put on, you want to say a word or two, Ben?
They put on more study classes on different topics of Buddhism. So we're supposed to, we're in the practice wing here, and the Sati Center is the study wing. So if you want to take, you know, learn about teachings of Buddhism and things like that.
And they meet usually over at St. Mark's, and most of their stuff is in Palo Alto. And the other thing I'll also say very quickly is Spirit Rock, which is a retreat center which Gil is a teacher at. And if you don't have enough sitting here, they have one-day programs, and they have retreats from 1 day to 2 months. Mm-hmm. And there's literature usually out there about that. Now about the mailing list, if you want to get on the mailing list and get our newsletter, I'm going to put out some sign-up sheets out there and put your name and address, and if you want your phone number, email, whatever you want to put on there. In addition, we also have a directory, and if you want to be in the directory or just want to put your address in the directory or just your phone number, check off what you want in there, and we'll only put in those things that you want. Any questions?
Yeah. Where is St. Mark's?
St. Mark's is
600 Colorado.
Yeah, 600 Colorado. It's directly across Middlefield, around three quarters of a block in on your left. It's going this way.
Across Middlefield?
The Middlefield is out over here, like three blocks out on Colorado.
The website.
Oh, yeah, we do have a website. And
there are pages out there tonight.
Yeah, and there's also the newsletter has the web page. One more thing, there's also a satellite group for this group down in San Jose, so for those of you who have it's too long to travel here, and that's in the newsletter also. Yes?
Where in Portola Valley?
It's at the Portola Valley Community Center. Do you know what that is? Oh, and the maps show you very clearly how to get there. Any other? Yes?
What age group for the children's?
They're probably about 5, 6 to 13.
Anything else? Any other?
Question?
Yeah?
The directory, is that available on the website, or can you get a copy of it? And to be in it, I read it in the newsletter, but I don't know whether you're directory or not.
Well, we used to put out the mailing list as the directory, and then we realized we were really violating a lot of people's personal information, and so that's when we started this whole movement to find out if people want to be in the directory and what they wanted in there. So that started in the last 6 months. So if you just send me a note or call me up or afterwards, tell me if you want to be in the directory and what you want in there, we'll make sure that happens.
How do you see the
we haven't come out with this directory yet. There are 900 names on our mailing list. 600 have phone numbers, and Pesha Edwards, who's on our board, did a whole thing with people to get to find out if they wanted to be directory. We only had 92 people. So now she's going through this whole effort to actually call people up and ask them if they want to be directory. So once that's all done, we'll come out with the directory.
More questions can be afterwards.
Yeah, you can see me afterwards in the back, and I'll put the sign-up sheets and answer your other questions. Thank you.
So that brings us to 8:30, and So maybe we'll just then end with my expression of gratitude to all of you, and I hope that this was useful, this 5-week course for you, and I hope that it brings you much benefit and benefits the people that you encounter. And may you all be well and happy, and have a wonderful week. Thank you.